This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. You know, everyone remembers the fall of Baghdad in 2003 after the massive U.S. invasion. Well, we may be on the verge of seeing a second fall of Baghdad, only this time to Islamist forces that are taking major Iraqi cities one by one, while the Iraqi military seems helpless. Mosul to Crete, Fallujah, on the march to Baghdad. Deputy White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest had a bit of a pep talk for the people of Iraq yesterday.
A lot of this aggression is targeting innocent Iraqi citizens. It's despicable. And we stand with the Iraqi people as they fight it.
And there was some upbeat spin from Stuart Jones, President Obama's appointee, to fill the position of U.S. ambassador to Iraq at his Senate confirmation hearing.
Although the news from Mosul is very bad, I think one positive aspect of this may be that the groups are indeed coming together to address this challenge. At least we're seeing signs of that in the last 24 hours.
Well, we probed very hard to find anything positive to say about the current developments in Iraq in a quite frankly alarming conversation with retired Lieutenant General James M. Dubik. America, he says, has to find the political will to return to Iraq in some capacity or watch everything the U.S. achieved there go to waste. General Dubik oversaw training of Iraqi security forces from 2007 to 2008. He is now a senior fellow at the Institute for the Study of War. Welcome, General.
John, thank you for the invitation.
You know, let me hit you with a really hard one right at the top here. You know, this looks a little bit like Saigon 1975. This roll-up is happening really fast. It's concerning me, considering all of the investment we made in Iraq. Convince me that I'm totally off base here.
No, I can't. This phase is happening quickly, but this is not the start of their counteroffensive. This started in 2011, and there was a series of campaigns that al-Qaeda in Iraq, then ISIS, the Islamic State in Syria and the Levant, have waged. And this was below anyone's radar screen here, even though we at the Institute for the Study of War have been writing about it pretty prolifically.
Does that mean that the strategists in the Pentagon and in the Obama administration were too narrow in their view? They were thinking purely within the borders of Iraq and not thinking regionally here?
Well, I don't know what their specific shortcomings may or may not have been, but it was clear, at least to me and to our analysts, that the efforts in Syria by the ISIS and the efforts in Iraq were joined. And they were joined together, acknowledged by al-Qaeda at the time. The effort is aimed at creating an Islamic State that includes most of northeastern Syria and much of north, central, and western Iraq. That state, if it's created, and right now the momentum is on ISIS's side, if that state is created, it is not in the interest of the United States. It's exactly the kind of sanctuary that we have been fighting to prevent since 9/11.
Now, I'm just looking at the map here. It seems to me as though U.S. passivity in Syria created a chaos and sanctuary opportunity for ISIS inside Syria so that they were easily able to resupply their troops from bases and sanctuaries inside Syria. So the instability in Syria actually has contributed to their ability to operate inside Iraq. Am I wrong there?
No, the instability in Syria is exactly a main contributing cause of the instability in Iraq. It's not the only cause, but it is a main contributing cause.
What would you say about the weakness or the apparent weakness and sectarian problems with the Iraqi government as it's currently constituted as a weakness in fighting back here?
Well, there's no doubt that the government of Iraq has made mistakes in terms of their domestic policies that has caused disillusionment and other problems in major parts of the population, mostly Sunni. It's also no doubt that the government of Iraq's security policies have made the security forces more fragile than they were in 2008 and 9 and 10. But those things are long-term fixes. Right now, the issue is, number one, stop the ISIS offensive, and two, transition into a counteroffensive. Absent those two tasks being successful, any discussion about domestic policies in Baghdad or in Washington are moot.
For the Iraqis to actually do this, don't they have to unite Sunni, Kurd, and Shia and deliver some sort of united military front to ISIS? I don't see how that's possible.
Well, they're incapable of doing it by themselves right now. That's why, personally, I advocate the use of U.S. Air, manned and unmanned, the use of U.S. advisors to include ground controllers to make sure that those airstrikes are used in a precise way and targeted correctly, and the advisors to help the Iraqis with what they obviously cannot do, and that's conduct a proper large-scale defense and plan a large-scale counteroffensive.
Now, let's just stipulate that this is neither of our expertise, but my gut says Obama's not going there.
Well, I don't know whether he will or won't. Decisions change based on conditions. These conditions are dire, and these conditions are directly related to creating exactly the kind of sanctuary that the United States policy has been to prevent.
Let's talk Turkey and Iran for a moment. I mean, if the instability because of ISIS pushes the Kurds across the border into Turkey, that makes a completely different situation all of a sudden. And Turkey has asked for the UN Security Council to get involved here, partly, I think, because of the Kurdish instability in northern Iraq. And what's Iran's role here?
Well, if the ISIS is successful, the Islamic State of Syria and the Levant will border Turkey, Iran, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Lebanon. It will be a very destabilizing force for the region, for Israel, and it's a major threat to the United States because, again, it's a sanctuary from which we can expect planning for attacks on U.S. interests and U.S. Soil to occur.
If the U.S. were to stay completely out of this, who are the players in the region that might be expected to get involved, and would that be a good thing, or would that create a conflagration?
For me, the most likely place for the government of Iraq to turn, if we don't help them, is to Iran. And this would not be helpful to the region. It wouldn't be helpful to the United States. And in fact, it's not in the long-term interest of Iraq, and that's why Prime Minister Maliki, when he came last fall, asked for our help.
Isn't that the biggest irony of all, that Iraq would turn to Iran as a way of maintaining its territorial integrity after what happened in 2003 when the U.S. invaded?
John, I can't even begin to describe my emotions on that particular subject. What's clear to everyone is that the Iraqis cannot stop the ISIS offensive by themselves, and that the situation is dire, and that the two main tasks right now are stop the offensive and transition to a counteroffensive. We can help with that without redoing the surge. No one's talking about something like that. This is their task to do. They know it. They've asked for our help, and I think our help should come in three categories. Airstrikes, fixed wing, rotary wing, manned and unmanned. Air controllers to make sure these strikes are targeted precisely, and advisors to help the Iraqis plan and execute the large-scale operations that we know they don't have the capacity to do.
Retired Lieutenant General James M. Dubik oversaw training of Iraqi security forces from 2007 to 2008. He's now a senior fellow at the Institute for the Study of War. Thank you so much, I guess, for that very sobering conversation, General.
Well, John, thank you for the interview. It's no pleasure to give that kind of report, but it is accurate.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.